Our next case this morning is number 06-4362, Automobile Mechanics Local 701 Welfare and Pension Funds against Vanguard Car Rental. Good morning, Mr. McDowell.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephen McDowell. I represent the plaintiffs' appellants, the Automobile Mechanics Local 701 Welfare and Pension Funds in this matter today. Basically, there are three major areas to be addressed with respect to this case. The first would be whether the district court improperly dismissed this case sua sponte on improper venue grounds in favor of an arbitration forum. The second would be if the court rules that that is the case, whether this case should be appropriately decided initially on summary judgment by this court, or whether a remand should be ordered to either the former circuit district court judge or another district court judge under Rule 36. And finally, should this court decide it wishes to rule upon the merits of this case, there would be an argument with respect to the merits and whether the funds properly increased the amount of contributions due Vanguard in August 2005.
Now, Mr. McDowell, there doesn't seem to be much dispute between the parties anymore about the venue.
That's correct.
Point, and I have to say, in my view, rightly so, since I think it's quite clear that under the rules, venue is a waivable matter, and when a case is advanced as far as this one had, the arguments are very strong for waiver. Vanguard also raises a subject matter jurisdiction argument that you might want to address, but it seems to me we're really here, at least in terms of what you might want to spend your time on, at least to hear what you have to say about the merits. Obviously,
all right,
we'll decide whether we want to remand or not.
That's fine, because with respect to the remand argument, basically our simple point was here was simply because the district court has kind of made this a practice of dismissing these cases sua sponte in favor of arbitration. We had some questions as to if the case was remanded, whether there would be an appropriate hearing before the district court, but we would leave that matter to the court's discretion.
Does Judge Nargle have every one of these cases?
Yes. Basically, that's correct. Each of the cases that we cited in our brief, as well as the ones that we brought to the court's attention in our supplemental authorities last week, were all decided by Judge Norgo.
But are there any facts or other proceedings that need to be developed? It looks to me like this is all about how one interprets paragraphs 5 and 8 of the participation agreements. And if you can tell me that there are facts that you would want the proceedings in a district court for, then obviously the case for remand is stronger.
No. Basically, we don't believe that there are really any significant additional facts from the fund's point of view. I think both in the district court, both the funds and Vanguard basically treated this matter as largely a matter of contract interpretation with respect to the participation agreements, and also with respect to whether the participation agreements are, in fact, as we discussed previously, a subject matter jurisdiction or an independent basis for subject matter jurisdiction under Section 515 of ERISA. So we would agree, and I think as far as I understand, Vanguard likely also agrees that this is basically a matter involving contract interpretation and the legal issue of subject matter jurisdiction.
And it's now, well, and of course, as I said, if you want to say something about Vanguard's argument on that, that's fine. I know you've addressed it in your brief as well. But just to move things forward a bit, I have to say, reading paragraphs 5 and 8 myself, there is such a close tie between the pension participation agreements, I'll call them, and the collective bargaining agreement that I find your reading strained at best. You really seem to kind of seize on this phrase "and thereafter" in paragraph 8, whereas we're not within a collective bargaining agreement period or a renewed period. We're in the the status quo period in between CBAs. And the rest of labor law says you just preserve the status quo, and you're, in effect, arguing for an exception.
Yes, basically what we're arguing in this case is because what we have with respect to this situation is we have agreements which aren't between the employer and the union. Rather, they're between the employer and the benefit fund.
No, I understand right. that, but if you look at the language of those agreements, and especially paragraph 8, it says if the employer is bound to the provisions of this agreement for the period of the next collective bargaining agreement and thereafter until proper notice is given, and then it refers to any renewed term for the rate that the Board of Trustees establishes. So we have to decide, do those words "and thereafter" and "any renewed term" mean other collective bargaining agreements and a renewed term of the CBA, or does it mean a renewed term somehow of this standalone participation agreement between the funds and the employer?
For that, I would basically refer the court to our discussion at page 7 of our reply brief. And what I would note is, and I think this is the critical point to bear in mind with respect to paragraph 8, the sentence that the court was bringing our attention to indicates that the employer shall be bound to the provisions of the agreement for the period of the next collective bargaining agreement and thereafter until proper notice is given, but in no event less than 3 years unless terminated by the trustees. It's our position that that three-year language is the language that gives the additional period of time, that there is a minimum period of 3 years following the termination of the collective bargaining agreement, the purpose being basically to give the funds security that they will be, in fact, seeing those contributions at the level called for.
But there's another step that you have to also take before you come to the result that you want, because this employer, at least, seems perfectly happy to keep paying contributions at the rate established in the now expired collective bargaining agreement.
Right.
And you really have to kind of link this additional 3 years that you're arguing for with kind of a freestanding ability of the Board of Trustees to make up a new contribution rate. And that requires reading the term "any renewed term" to mean this freestanding agreement as opposed to what the language of this looks more like, a renewed term of the CBA.
Again, we submit that is the proper reading.
But why? I mean, why should we say renewed term when the only thing this paragraph is talking about is renewing the CBA?
Well, if we turn back to paragraph 5, it indicates the agreement shall remain in full force and effect for the term of the current collective bargaining agreement and shall automatically be renewed from time to time for terms coterminous with the collective bargaining agreement. The rate at which contributions are to be made during any renewed term shall be that set by the Board of Trustees. What we're dealing here is the renewed term of the participation agreement, because that's the only basic agreement that we have before us in this particular matter and that
but
the trustees were able to enter.
I think you're pulling it out of context of these two paragraphs, because you would agree, I'm sure, that in general these participation agreements between an employer and a fund are part of an actual three-party relationship. You've got your CBA between the employer and the union. You've got your participation agreement. The union and the employer both have an interest in how the fund is operated, and these are linked very closely together. So to de-link them in this way is again, it's a rather unusual move.
Well, the reason for that is it gives the benefit funds, as indicated previously, an additional basis, basically, of security with respect to the fact that contributions will be coming in. Otherwise, the participation agreement basically becomes superfluous in many ways, because the collective bargaining agreement would be the entire basis.
Not at all.
For
you
coverage.
Wouldn't have anything to bind the funds. You need to be party to an agreement.
Well,
if there were no agreement between the funds and the employer to supplement the collective bargaining agreement, which is between the employer and the union, you would just, as the funds, have to rely on some third-party beneficiary argument. Saying it out loud makes a big difference. And I would also say you could write an agreement that does what you say, but this is a very elliptical way to do it.
Well, again, we would assert that the agreement has, in fact, accomplished that. And then with respect to the third-party beneficiary argument, I think under this court's decisions and Gerber Truck and the like, it's relatively clear that there is going to be a third-party beneficiary point just simply as a matter of law and the basis for the funds. And so the reason for the participation agreements is basically to supplement the collective bargaining agreement, and in this case to establish this minimum 3-year period after the collective bargaining agreement expires for a requirement for additional contributions to be made in amounts established by the Board of Trustees. And it's that basis, the basis of the participation agreements, which then creates, in essence, the subject matter jurisdiction here, because what are involved in this particular case are promised contributions under the advanced lightweight decision, because they are promised contributions pursuant to the terms of this participation agreement. And in essence, then, the agreement and the merits of the agreement, when we turn to them, the agreement very clearly establishes that contributions shall be due in the amounts established by the boards of trustees. In August 2005, the trustees looked at this matter, determined that contributions should, in fact, be increased. This is not inconsistent with any public policy of this court in ERISA collection cases, as both the Gerber Truck case as well as Martin versus Garmin Construction fairly clearly indicate that NLRA-based public policy should not be considered an obstacle to the requirement that contributions be made pursuant to written agreements between the funds and the particular parties involved. And the professional administrators case from the Sixth Circuit that was cited by Vanguard would thus be largely beside the point, because that case dealt with a Section 301 matter, and it dealt with an issue with respect to that case of NLRA-based public policy being a recognized defense, which it isn't in an ERISA collection case. And finally, with respect to the Amex Coal case, we would note that that case specifically did permit trustees to increase contributions. The particular agreement involved in that case permitted that, and the Supreme Court didn't indicate there was any difficulty with respect to it. So accordingly, as discussed previously, I think as conceded by both sides, I think the district court's decision with respect to sending this matter to arbitration was inappropriate. We believe subject matter jurisdiction exists under the participation agreements in Section 515 of ERISA, and that the participation agreements involved appropriately permitted the funds to increase the amount of contributions that were due beginning August 1, 2005. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McDowell. We'll hear now from Mr. Pelton.
Morning, Your Honors. Let me start by apologizing. There is a fairly important fact that the briefs didn't get to. Maybe it was such a fundamental one, we all took it for granted and overlooked it. But I think we also have to look at paragraph 1 of the participation agreement in addition to 5 and 8. And it really brings home, I think, the point that we're making. Paragraph 1 of the participation agreement states that the employer will make contributions in an amount required by and defined in the collective bargaining agreement. And that's what we've been doing. And you'll recall from the facts in the brief that the collective bargaining agreement said once it expires and until there's an impasse, we will be obligated to continue to pay at that same rate. So in essence, the bargaining agreement is still dictating what we pay, and I think under paragraph 1, that's fairly conclusive. Now, the issue then that's really being raised factually by the plaintiff is does it have a right? It certainly has a right to set new rates for a renewed term. So the question is, does the renewed term start on expiration of the first collective bargaining agreement, and this provision carries over in the bargaining agreement right now, or on commencement of a new one? And it's only for a renewed term that they can raise these rates. Now, the renewed term is defined as being coterminous with the next collective bargaining agreement. Its renewed term is in there three times. Coterminous means it runs together, I think. It's not for the continuation for the duration of the next or not through the end of the next. It's certainly not from expiration of the bargaining agreement through the end of the next. It says it runs coterminous.
Can I ask you, there's no argument here, I take it, that the amount of these employer contributions for the funds is itself an issue, as in the Sixth Circuit case, for example, is itself an issue for collective bargaining? You would concede that the trustees have this ability to decide?
Oh, no, I wouldn't concede that at all. I think it is a subject of bargaining. And let me distinguish. There's a number of cases here that I think are rightly decided, Gerber and some of those out of this circuit. But in all of those cases cited, that wasn't the question. The question was, are we obligated to be in the plan or can we get out of the plan? Mm-hmm. Here, though, you're actually getting into an issue of rates. And let's talk for a minute about how these things work in actuality.
So before you do that, in the old collective bargaining agreement, there are the rates specified for the two different kinds of for the two different plans or funds, and that was the subject of collective bargaining between the employer and the union. Or did the fund have any role in that number?
Well, of course, it's a subject of bargaining, and what happens in reality is the union or the employer say we want to participate in these funds. They go to the funds and say, what's the rate it's going to cost us to participate in these funds? Mm-hmm. And you then bargain over that and make a decision. And I think the same thing then is going to apply in this carryover period, because as the participation agreement says, we're obligated to pay pursuant to that bargaining agreement in the amounts designated in the bargaining agreement. Now, we want to enter into a new bargaining agreement. We're negotiating over that. We have to find out what the rates are going to be for the renewed term. We're not there yet, and there's certainly nothing in the participation agreement that requires us to pay at an increased rate until there is a renewed term.
And for these particular funds, I recall this from the briefs, it's the case, is it not, that different employers who participate in it at any given time are probably paying different rates?
I'm sure they're staggered. Yeah, if you get in this year, it might cost you less than it does next year. There may be situations where they say if you're going to have a three-year contract, it's going to be this for the 3 years. They have to actuarially look at that. Mm-hmm. That's the economic reality of this thing, just like if we went and purchased them from Blue Cross or through our own plans. So in practice, the contract makes sense as we interpret it, because it is going to be a subject of bargaining. And that, Your Honors, is where I think the Sixth Circuit Copper Glow case, as well as the Supreme Court case in Amex, comes in terms of this public policy. The funds can't dictate what is really a subject of bargaining over the amount we're going to have to pay for benefits. And again, that's distinguishable from cases like Gerber and Marine and some of the others cited, where it was a question of their ability to withdraw, not over rates. Let me just finally address their argument concerning paragraph 8 in the 3 years. It seems to me that if we don't exercise the right to get out of this thing, then the three-year provision is really an extension. And if and when there is a next, and that's still a question, if there's going to be a next, they have the right to set it for that, and we have a right to bargain over whether we want to enter into that. If there's not, then you have this three-year extension where we continue under this participation agreement. It's, in essence, a carryover. But it's not a renewal without the next collective bargaining agreement. And this protects the employer from paying higher than agreed-to rates without bargaining. And the trust is protected ultimately because it can terminate this thing if they don't want to continue to carry us at the old rates. So,
but it's also protected presumably because there's this three-year workout period so that they can phase you out. I don't know how long you're going to be at impasse with these collective bargaining negotiations, it sounds like.
Well, we're not at impasse.
Not quite there.
Yeah,
okay.
it's a hiatus or bargaining period, I suppose. But okay. Let me just take another example. Let's assume we did enter into a new two-year agreement, bargaining agreement. Then you have a renewed term. They can set the rate for those 2 years. Then you have a third year, I guess, which in essence is at the option of the trustees at that point. Do we want to continue at that rate, or do we want to take them out of the plan? The point is Vanguard continues to pay at the rate set in the collective bargaining agreement. It's continuing to pay that pursuant to the bargaining agreement's carryover provision, which says you'll continue to pay at this rate until there's a new agreement, which I think dovetails nicely with the participation agreement. And the trust, if they want, can take Vanguard out of the plan, or the trust can set a new rate for the next contract when that's entered into. But they can't dictate rates between the contract that have not been negotiated. And that, again, is, I think, where this policy argument of Amex and Copper Glow come into play.
Is there any other situation you can think of where the trustees would have the right unilaterally in the middle of a CBA term to change the rates?
I think if they'd reserved that right in the participation agreement and we had bargained over it, in other words, we meet with the union and the union and the employer agree we're going to go into this trust fund, mm-hmm. into this plan. To go into that plan, there may be any number of requirements. There may be a term requirement. There may be rate requirements. There may be requirements concerning when you can get out and when you can't get out. And I think you see that at play in some of this court's earlier decisions, such as Gerber, where there's those types of provisions that will be enforced. The point here is that they're simply lacking. So ERISA is certainly an important statute. It has some very strong abilities for trusts to enforce when things aren't being paid. It's weighted in favor of the trusts, and I think that's probably a good thing, and this court has certainly recognized this. But we're not trying to avoid an oral agreement or get around this by oral agreement, as in Gerber. We're not a deadbeat employer, as in some of these cases. There's nothing really for Vanguard to manipulate in the manner of Gerber or in the manner that the Gerber case was concerned about. There's nothing nefarious or secret about this. Vanguard's paying what it agreed to pay. If and when there's a new collective bargaining agreement, it'll pay the new rate set by the union if that's what's agreed to. In the interim, the plaintiff's remedy here, if any, would be to take us out of the plan. Are there any other questions?
I guess not, Mr. Pelton.
Thank you very much.
How much time does Mr. McDowell have? Thank you.
Just to briefly respond to a couple of points here. I think when you look at the entire participation agreement, it will become clear that what's being discussed here is the renewal of the participation agreement and the renewed period of that. And most specifically, we call the court's attention to the three-year period because it's that three-year minimum period that basically provides a level of security against increased contributions. Were this to be otherwise, we would have a situation where after the collective bargaining agreement ended, if medical costs went up, if pension costs went up, the employer would still be permitted to pay at the lesser rate, and that's simply not what was contemplated, we believe, by the terms of the participation agreement with respect to...
Mr. Pelton argues that the fund can protect itself by terminating the participation agreement, basically telling the employer you're out. Of course, that triggers in itself some significant...
Yes, the fund has that option. We don't disagree with that. The terms of the participation agreement are such that they are terminable by the fund, but the fund also has this three-year provision, and we would note that the three-year provision is not at the rate in the collective bargaining agreement. The paragraph 8 states very clearly it's at the rate that the contributions are to be made is to be that set by the Board of Trustees. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McDowell and Mr. Pelton as well, for your very fine oral arguments. The case will be taken up.